The Guardian.
It's a very strong memory, you know. When I was in the children's home in the UK, I was only 10. This man in a suit, he came to see me and he says, "How'd you like to go to Australia?" You know, he said, "The sun shines every day. You'd live in a white house, ride a horse to school, and you pick oranges off the trees for your breakfast."
Hello and welcome to a very special edition of Film Weekly with me, Simon Hattonstone. This week's show is dedicated to a special screening and Q&A at the Barbican here in London with director Jim Loach and his debut feature film, Oranges and Sunshine. The film tells the story of a horrific and tragic policy of forced migration of children from the UK to Australia from the post-war era up to 1970. Thousands of children that ended up in the care system here in the UK were sent abroad, often to a life of hard labour and abuse. These horrific acts of forced migration were uncovered and brought to public attention through the courageous efforts of a Nottingham social worker, Margaret Humphreys, played superbly by Emily Watson, who, in the mid-1980s, was contacted by one of the victims of this forced migration looking for help.
Well, what you're looking for isn't really what this group does. This is it's a local support group, really. I might be able to refer you to somebody who'd be able to offer you counselling.
What counselling? I want to find out who I am.
Well, this isn't really the way to...
I don't even know if my name and birth date are right. I remember leaving England. I was 4 years old. I was in a children's home because my parents were dead. Then they sent me in a boat to Australia. All I know for certain is I was born in Nottingham.
What do you mean they put you on a boat?
It was all in a boat for us, hundreds of us.
What, your adoptive parents were emigrating?
No parents, no guardians, just a couple of hundred kids. They sent us away.
Well, that can't be right.
What do you mean?
Well, it's simply not legal. There's no way that a group of unaccompanied children would just be shipped off.
You're calling me a liar.
The film goes on to trace Margaret's realisation and exposure of the forced migration and her years of struggle to assist those survivors reconnect with their families. After my interview with Jim, we opened it up to questions from the audience, many of whom who asked about one specific character, Len, played by Australian actor David Wenham.
"I just want to find my mother. That's it. Help me with that if you can. I don't need anything else."
"I'm not offering anything else. That's not my place. All I'm asking is, have you imagined what it might be like if we do find her?"
"Okay, well, let's just find her first, all right? I'm sure that you see old boys and girls day in, day out, bawling their eyes out, telling you how much they miss their dear old mum. Well, the truth is, our mum shot through, didn't they? We didn't just fall out of our prams and fly off with Peter Pan, did we? No, our mums didn't want us. That's why we're here. Isn't that the truth?"
"No, the truth is actually much more complicated in most cases."
"No, she didn't want me. She put me in a children's home. Well, that's all right. Let's just put a face to the old deal."
Len does go on to put a face to his mother's name in a scene that stirred deep emotions in both myself and the audience. Len's gritty stoicism and humour and willingness to help out those who abused him as a child really caught our imaginations. Jim Loach, it goes without saying, comes from a noted family of film directors, and although this is his first feature, his established credits as a TV director and maybe something in the DNA mean that this is a really finely made film. So I hope you enjoy our discussion of Oranges and Sunshine. Thanks. I just want to say welcome on behalf of The Guardian and Observer. I want to welcome Jim as well. It's actually very hard to interview, I think, after a film like that, because it's so, as well as beautifully made, it's incredibly powerful. So apologies to me if I just burst out crying in the middle. I want to get right to... Tell me about the genesis of the film, Jim.
It started about 8 or 9 years ago, I guess. I'd read Margaret's book called Empty Cradles, and I went to visit her. And she's got like a small office in Nottingham. And I just sat opposite her, and I can't remember a huge amount about the kind of, it was a lot of tea and biscuits, and I just started, she just started to tell me her story. And I think she got like about four or five sentences in, and I was completely sort of spellbound. I found it absolutely captivating. And I found her a kind of incredibly inspirational person to be around. And as soon as she started to talk, I knew it was a film I wanted to make.
And this was 8 years ago?
Yeah, I think nine actually.
And has she been involved in the process?
She had, yeah. I mean, we went through many drafts of the script, obviously, over a period of about at least 4 years. And obviously I would go up to Nottingham, show Margaret the script and get her feedback and thoughts and suggestions. So we tried to incorporate as many as we could. And we also met, of course, we met many former child migrants, many. I spoke to a lot of them, as did Rona, and we kind of got many thoughts and suggestions from them.
Rona, is that
Rona? Rona Munro, who wrote the script.
Yeah. Rona Munro, the script writer.
That's right. And the people we met, to us, became quite heroic characters, really deeply inspirational characters. I mean, characterised, of course, very different in many ways, but what they had in common was this incredible sense of humour. They were absolutely survivors, nothing to do, they didn't want to be victims.
Is Len like Len?
Very much, yeah, more so. Yeah.
More Len than Len. You can't be more Len than Len.
No, we had to tone him down because when we wrote it out, you wouldn't believe it, so we had to de-Len him. But he's a fantastic guy, an amazing guy, and David actually went to go and visit him, and they spent a weekend together, and just before we started to shoot, and I still don't know what happened on that weekend. I can't get to the bottom of it, but David came back like holding his head, and you know, sort of. But he was also absolutely.
You need to use second names to explain to people
who David Wenham, who played the character of Len. So they kind of met their opposite numbers, really.
And the testimonies, yeah. I mean, I don't know about what you all feel, but one of the most powerful things is the testimonies from the people. How were they gathered? Was that almost by an interviewing process? Was that from Margaret's book?
Rona Munro wrote the script, sat with dozens of them, of former child migrants over a long period of time. And so we met many, many, many of them. And from that, so then we'd come back to London, and we never had a problem about like too little material. The problem was always like notebooks stacked up with all this extraordinary stuff, and often we'd say any individual that we met, you could make a film of their story. Absolutely. I mean, every single one of them had an incredible story to tell about, you know, being uprooted from this country and being told their parents had died and being lied to systematically, and then sort of discovering, you know, their real identity, and going back to meet parents sometimes. I mean, it was extraordinary stuff. But we kind of kept coming back to Margaret's story, really, as a motor for the film. And I think that was because we were fascinated by her central dilemma, her central problem, which is that she's obviously out trying to uncover the truth and bring people to account. And she's trying to reunite families, but at the same time, she's trying to keep her own family together. Mm. So that, for us, became this sort of central motor for the story.
I mean, I think that's one of the most powerful things, and it's something I've seen a lot of in life, people who give up their life to help people who've been traumatised, and you almost see the trauma passing from the victim to the helper. And there's one wonderful moment in the film where I think you can almost visibly see it going from Len to her, and he's shot and he's like, what has happened? Was that part of the story you wanted to tell, in effect, the impact it had?
It was absolutely part of the story, because that was part of Margaret's experience, and something that we sort of talked about a lot with Margaret over the time we were sort of developing the script. So it was part of the story we wanted to
tell. And what did she think when she felt the film, saw the film? I mean, it's quite a painful film, I would imagine, to see you're the heroine of the film, but also there's an element of screwing up family life. There's your own kind of increasing vulnerability coming through.
Well,
how did she feel? Did she watch it like that?
I wasn't in the screening room when she watched it. I thought I wouldn't put myself through that one. But we sat outside like naughty children, really. And she really likes it a lot. Yeah, she's really comfortable with it. She said to us that she felt it was very faithful to her experience, and so that meant a great deal to us.
And have the people, have the, you know, the victims seen the film?
Yeah,
I don't like the word victims.
What's the survivors.
The survivors. Don't like the word survivors.
We showed them the film in we've had a few screenings in Australia, one in Perth, in particular. Many of them got together and watched it, and it was a very memorable afternoon. It was extraordinary, and it will really stay with us for a long time. It was obviously very heightened and deeply emotional, but they really took ownership of it, and that meant a great deal to us.
I can imagine. It's been so powerful. What's happened to the Charles Migrants Trust? I mean, that was
They're still going strong. They're busier than ever. So it's still, Margaret's still doing exactly the same work. I mean, the woman that kind of we met and kind of gave rise to the Pauline character, who was the woman with the mop, played by Tara Maurice. The real person behind that character only found her mum in Canada, actually, a couple of months ago, and they were reunited. And
so it's an ongoing story, isn't it? It's a permanent evolution.
Yeah.
And how old is Margaret now?
21.
She's not here tonight, is she?
am I allowed to say? Early 60s.
Early 60s.
Yeah.
And I wanted to ask you something, Jim. You seem to have a rather familiar name. Jim. We've all heard the name Jim. Has Uncle Ken seen the film yet?
I did a little screening and showed him, and then he popped into the cutting room and gave me a few suggestions. Which obviously, like any dutiful son, I completely ignored.
Good.
And I did a few of them.
Now I want to know about, because I know this family quite well, and I know that you and your sister, did you not promise faithfully that the one thing you never wanted to do was go into film? It's like, the one thing we're not going to do is go into film. And Emma is now a filmmaker, you're a filmmaker. What's going on?
It was, I can't explain it really properly. And obviously when I get asked that, I feel like I should give a more coherent answer. It's just that the pull was sort of irresistible, really. That's what it was. I just had found that I made peace with the idea of doing it, which I had to do. And once I'd done that, I knew that I wanted to do it.
You knew you'd be better anyway, didn't you? So I can. I think we should probably open it up to the floor, because we've only got half an hour. But I just wanted to ask about, I mean, would you say you were a political filmmaker? Obviously, Ken is one. One, would you say you were a political filmmaker? And were you never tempted to rebel and, like, you know, kind of go and join the BNP or something?
Do you know what? The only thing I can't do is comparisons, because I just feel like that's fine for other people, but I couldn't compare myself to my dad, obviously, in any way. I don't really see myself particularly as a political filmmaker, but that's not by way of comparison to anyone, because I just couldn't get into that.
I'm going to open it up. I just want to say I'm still quite stunned from that film. I thought it was so powerful and so good and so beautifully told. So if I forget to thank you afterwards, I'm going to thank you now. So can we have some questions? Can we have the man at the bottom with the hand up?
Mention was made at the end of the film that both governments apologised. Was there anything forthcoming beyond the apology that might have explained the rationale as to how or why this happened? I know there were a lot of different institutions, presumably, who contributed to it, but was there anything more meaty that came out of that?
There is a document that's available that was written at the Home Office, which detailed that a ticket from Liverpool to Sydney cost £10, but it cost £8 a month to keep that child in care. So someone had kind of worked it out. So that was a factor, the economics. And obviously in Australia, they were actually, you know, trying to build the population, and there was the whole White Australia thing too. And they were seen as good workers. There is a phrase on another document that describes good white stock. So those are some of the reasons, economics.
While we're at the bottom, can we go to Guy Two Away, thanks.
Yeah. Allow me two questions. One is maybe following up on this one, but it's in terms of motivation. Are the same people that were involved in the removal of the Aborigine children to, you know, the hinterland, the same people doing this for the other type of migration? And the second question is, until very recently, most of the migrants that went to Australia by this means were not allowed to return. So make it seem as it's very easy for these people to come back and visit their families, but until I reckon it's 1980s, they were not even allowed to set foot here. And I was wondering if you could comment on that.
It was a challenge. The second part, in terms of coming back, there is a challenge for a lot of former child migrants until recently, that sometimes they would find living parents here, but obviously they in some cases couldn't afford the plane ticket back. And until recently, no one was really picking up the tab for that. So there was definitely an issue about people coming back here to find their parents, being able to afford it, and so that's a factor. I mean, in terms of the earlier part, I think the Aboriginal thing is a separate issue. But I mean, there are a lot of similarities, and we were struck by the similarities. But I think it's very much a separate issue, and the former child migrants that we met very much feel that their story has differences too. It's a different story.
Another question.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you know how many children have been reunited. There have been 130,000 children. It's unbelievable, that number.
Yeah, it's well into the thousands, I believe, early thousands. I know that Margaret herself has done many hundreds, so it's a lot.
Yeah, I just wondered, because Margaret came across as kind of quite isolated, or her and her organisation came across as quite isolated from the rest of the sort of social work profession. I mean, obviously she had the support of all the survivors and her family, but I just wondered kind of how accurate it was that they very much had to do it alone, or did they get other support from, I don't know, the social work profession or other organisations?
She was very much on her own in the early days. I mean, the story we really wanted to tell was Margaret's experience of that story at that time, and her experience was definitely that she was in it on her own. I mean, in real life there were other people which aren't represented in the film, but in terms of the actual uncovering, investigating, going backwards and forwards, she was very much on her own and dealing with it on her own. And you know, for me that was partly why I found her like a deeply inspirational person, because she kind of posed that kind of question of at what point would you walk away, you know, and say I've done my bit, and she never did. Absolutely, she didn't walk away, and although she had a lot thrown at her, so that was what attracted us to the story.
Sorry, can we go right to the top, please? The guy with the blue shirt, thanks.
I was just wondering, you said she had a lot thrown at her. Could you say by whom?
Well, both governments were in denial there was a problem. She was up against huge institutions, including you know, charitable bodies and, of course, the Catholic Church. And her experience at that time was one of denial. No one really wanted to know. No one wanted to recognise there was a big problem. So in that sense, she was kind of taking on a huge amount.
And given that she's actually continuing this work, does that opposition continue?
I think it's changed now. I think she would say that. I think, obviously, since the apologies, it's changed significantly. I know that, I mean, I was speaking to her yesterday, and I know that she still feels there is some denial in some aspects of this story, but I think there's probably been quite a seismic shift since both governments apologised.
Right, thank you.
Yeah, regarding the allegations of the sexual offences against the children, were any individuals ever brought to account in the Australian courts regarding these issues?
I'm not obviously totally qualified to speak about that, except that from our research, there were some class actions attempted in Australia. And they kind of ran aground on the basis that when it came near court, the priests were found to be either too old or not mentally fit to stand trial. And there were some very fumbled compensation claims which completely compounded the problem, because obviously then they had to put a tariff on abuse, which was a disaster. We would have liked to have filmed it at the Real Bindoon, actually, which was the children's home you see at the end, which was run by the Catholic Church. And we approached them and spent several months kind of talking to them, and we got lots of excuses, prevaricating, complete denial, and then eventually they said no. At one point they did say that we might have to go for a meeting at the Vatican, which I was really up for, and I kept...
It would have been great.
I was, yeah, but unfortunately they bottled it.
Shame. Any more for any more? Can we go to the middle, because we've conspicuously ignored the middle.
Hi, it's a beautiful movie, so well done. I just wanted to ask you about the footage at the end of the film. Where did you find that? And is it a truthful footage?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. We got it, it's newsreel, there were some notes accompanying it, and it absolutely is former child migrants, it came from one of the big news organisations, so it's absolutely news footage.
The stories are boys' stories, actually. Was there different procedures for the girls?
Sort of similar. But, I mean, a lot of the women we met were incredible, actually, really amazing people. And like I say, one of them met her mum just recently in Canada. And often they were sent to a Fairbridge, where they basically learned how to mop floors, clean. And then at an age of about 14 or 15, they were usually sent to private homes as home help. Very poorly educated, if educated at all. That was the experience of many of the women we met.
Any more for any more? Should we go back to the bottom, woman in the middle?
Were there any particular reasons for not giving more detail about Len's mother?
Yeah, there were. I mean, we actually had scenes in the script at one stage. Complicated is the truth. I mean, I'd love to tell that story, and I would love to make that film of the moment where he walks in through the door. But it's another film. It's not this one, and that's the short answer. There wasn't one scene that could remotely do it justice, because it's, of course, the start of another chapter, and an incredible, exciting chapter, but it's just not this film. Yeah.
Can you tell us, are they closely in touch now?
Yeah, they are, yeah. Yeah, they're in touch. And, you know, I mean, of course, as you'd expect, the truth is it's just not easy, yeah. You know. You can't get the time back. It's complicated. But they're in touch. And, they, you know, he comes over quite regularly to see them. So it's good in many, many ways.
Guy at the bottom with the cap. Thanks.
With the exception of Len, who's a little bit obstreperous to start with, all the other survivors seem deeply and quietly hurt and quite zen in the way that they deal with the aftermath. Were there no hellraisers, people who became bare-knuckle fighters or drug addicts or tried to burn the monastery down? And if so, how come they're not in the film?
We didn't meet any bare-knuckle fighters, as far as I think I'd remember if we had. But the characters we wrote kind of, they came from the experience of the people that we met. And when we met this one chap in Perth that started to become part of the basis for the Len character, he was the character for us that kind of unlocked the story. Because he was so emphatically not a victim. He's the opposite of a victim. You know, if you put your arm around this guy and ask offer of sympathy, he'll absolutely leg it. He's just not interested in being that person.
I think we've got time for one last question, which has to come from the squeezed middle, as that man who leads Labour would say, whatever his name is. Can we have the woman with, I think it's an orange top?
I wondered if your storyline about Len paying for everything, I just thought that was fascinating and fascinating psychology. Psychologically, is that true as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it was true of a lot of people we met that the ultimate irony was that they thought they owed the homes, and they were told specifically when you leave here you've got to pay us back, and for us that seemed like the ultimate irony of the situation, and a number of people we met had. Spent money doing up homes or putting in extra facilities like a swimming pool. So it absolutely came from the experience of the people we met. And for us, it was an incredible kind of twist.
Was that in the hope that the priest couldn't swim?
Yeah, well, maybe they're going to try and drown them.
Did that change at all when they met their own family or when someone was kind of representing them, or did they still feel they owed?
I think it's difficult to answer that, really, if truthfully, because, you know, it's difficult to speak for them, because, of course, I guess there would be lots of different answers from different people. I only know that it was a very deep-seated feeling in a lot of people we met, even at the point of us meeting them, which is sort of relatively recently in their lives. They've had just a general sense that they owed these places. And I think it was just because they were imbued with that as children, as they're growing up, you owe us and you've got to pay us back.
I think we've actually got to stop, which is a shame because we could go on for ages. So I want to thank Jim very much. It's a great film. I'm so glad that we've got a whole Lokes dynasty. Can I thank you all for coming as well on behalf of The Guardian? It's really great to see you, and thank you very much. Thank you for listening to this special edition of Film Weekly with me, Simon Huttonstone. Thanks also to The Barbican, Icon Distribution, a great audience, and Jim Loach. The podcast was produced by Jason Phipps. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.